Listen, Paul, all I'm saying is if you're not a pacifist by the end of this episode, I'm gonna punch you in the face.
Well, hey, this is Tipsy Theology, where we explore freedom in Christ through our freedom in alcohol. Dude, you got exciting news.
I do have exciting news.
You got a new pair of socks.
I got a new pair of socks, and my sister is currently in labor.
That's crazy.
And I got a new bottle of bourbon.
You really? No way.
And I'm very excited about it.
I've had Larceny before. That one's pretty good.
It's delicious. Yeah. So that's what I'm pouring first.
That's celebration right there. First time uncle. Blah, 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 yeah. Blah, this guy.
That's right. I'm going to corrupt that kid.
You have to. I mean, what kind of uncle do you think you're going to be? Do you want to be like the cool, fun one or like the...
I mean, if you can't tell what kind of uncle I'm going to be, Paul, I don't think you really know.
Well, no, which one do you want to be?
Well, obviously, I'm going to be the cool uncle.
I figured since everyone wants to do that, you'd try something a little different.
Ooh. Well, it's going to be like the cool, like, not like the cool, like, hey, do whatever you want, kid. But like the cool, like, hey, I'm going to do it with you, kid.
I'm going to do it with you. You're like,
what are you, five? You want to take a shot?
Try it out. You'll be doing this eventually.
Nah, I'm just kidding. No, she's going to have really cool parents, so I'll have to pick a different kind of cool. You're right.
Yeah, that's fair. Just be a man of power and mystery, whose power is only matched by his mystery.
Yeah, as long as there's mystery, there's power. That's right.
It's true. There's power in mystery.
I'm realizing I don't like these headphones.
They look cool. They match my tie.
Yeah, they're Beats by Dre.
By Dre?
Yeah.
Do you think he, like, touches each one of those? Is that how they get by that?
Mm-hmm. I heard that's that cool. He kisses them as they go by.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's a full-time job right there.
He gets paid a lot of money to do it.
Do you think he has, like, a substitute? He's like, if we could only automate this. He gets, like, a lip print. Just the machine then. Stamps it each time. That's fun.
Paul, what are we talking about today?
Well, apparently you're gonna beat me over the head. So this is actually a topic that I've been really excited to talk about for a while. So when we were first starting talking about doing this podcast, this was something that came up and I was like, we have to talk about this. And so I'm really excited that we're here talking about pacifism.
Yeah, it's always funny to me when I get in conversation with Christians, they get really interested that I'm a pacifist.
Yeah.
And I'm always I'm confused by that because I just felt like that was the way of Jesus, so.
No, over here like, can't be.
But no, I'm excited to get into it and hear your perspective on it and hopefully share mine in a particulate way.
I think that's what I'm interested in hearing as well, because there's what I have that comes to mind when I think of pacifism that might be different than the way you're defining it too.
Sure.
So yeah. That might be what we end up finding out. So we'll figure it out.
I'm willing to blur some lines every now and then. You got to be a little pragmatic, right?
It's true. A little blurry face. You know?
Anyways, shot number one.
Shot number one. What are you going with?
Dude, I showed you the bottle.
Oh, you're starting with Larceny?
Yeah.
Nice. I think so. Oh, man, what do I want to start with? I'll do that one last. I'm going to go here. I've actually, like, I'm, like, going for, like, the ends of some of them. So I got over here, we got this fancy Maker's
46.
Yeah. I still got some left in here. Oh, this one's a cork, too. That's nice. I really like this one. I'm kind of like at the end of it. So there's a part of me that's like, I don't want to finish them because I want to save them. But also I could just buy more. So this is like a good, it's a good stepping stone for me. I still have a little bit left. And that's just going to sit up on my shelf. But hey.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about doing this podcast is we always need to update our liquor cabinet.
It's true. It's true.
So.
I was trying to keep it at bay and then, well, I haven't. So. Cheers.
Cheers.
Woo! Stuff like that. It's like, that is not meant for shooting, but...
I forgot that was 120 proof.
Oh. But it certainly warms you up inside.
Feeling very, yeah.
Ooh. It's a good feeling.
All right. Ooh. What you got for number two? Ooh.
All right, so this one, I'm feeling a little nostalgic, so I've got this Cleveland bottle.
Okay.
So
that's pretty.
I think I really like the bottle. I love the font they have here. But the problem is the product inside. I'm not a huge fan.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it looks really pretty, and I can represent. But I'm just not, like, a huge fan of the way it tastes. It's got, like, this, like, synthetic kind of, like, fake flavor to it. Because they do the they do the rapid aging process.
Gross, yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of throws it off for me.
What'd you say the distillery was called?
This one is called, I think it's just
Cleveland on it.
Yeah.
It came from Cleveland.
I think it's just like Cleveland Brewing or something.
Okay.
Oh, Cleveland Whiskey. Nice and easy.
Wow.
Nice and easy.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going with Baku.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So his screen rolled out of mine. If I refresh, that won't stop the recording. Okay. We're testing this new technology yet. So I might disappear for a minute here, but I'll be back. Changes were made that may not be saved. Should I just hope his screen comes back on?
This has to be Ed's fault, right?
No, because
oh, you're back. It's Ed's fault. I don't know if we're going to keep that in or not, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's...
This is technology we're figuring out, you know? I'm an old man.
It's going to be fine.
It'll be good. But hey, Cleveland Whiskey.
Yes, sir. Baku, cheers.
Cheers.
Are you sure that we, are you sure we don't cheers every time? Because Annie told James that we don't, but I'm pretty sure we do.
Maybe we just do that now. I don't know. Is this when we just started? You know, she's always lying.
She's always come up with crazy stuff.
She's like, this will really mess with them.
All right, one more. What you got last? All right,
I got Jameson. Nice and simple.
Nice.
Did I tell you about my new, the new thing I'm doing?
No, what's up?
Well, first, actually, what are you drinking?
Tito's, baby.
Oh, you want Tito's.
I got this big bottle, the 1.75 liter.
Dang. I can't believe you're doing vodka on this show. Willingly.
I don't want to do it, but I have it.
Tito's is good.
My good stuff.
There's like just this tiny bit left, and I was like, oh, that'll fill it up, and it did. That's a full shot. No, so
I'm actually really...
What was that?
I'm upset about this shot. I haven't taken it yet. I'm so upset.
But here we are. Yeah, no, so I'm doing this new thing now. I've told, like, everyone about, I feel like. I watched one YouTube video, and I was like, oh, yeah, my posture, I can fix it. So I'm sleeping on the floor now.
I tried that.
Did you really?
I did not sleep. I didn't sleep at all.
So I've been doing it for about a little over a week now. Mm-hmm. And the first 4 days, just living hell. I would go to sleep and wake up. I'd get a full 8 hours of sleep, and it felt like 1.5. I woke up, I was like, did I even sleep? So it's kind of rough. But now it was like after like day four, beyond that point, it's like it's been pretty good. So I've been waking up and feeling pretty refreshed.
Okay, so what's the point of sleeping on the floor? How's this fix your posture?
I've got to embrace this minimalism thing. So what this chiropractor said was that since you're laying on the floor, it's not going to like mold to your body and kind of hug your poor posture, but it kind of forces your back to lie straighter.
Lay flat. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the theory. I don't know if there's anything behind it, but I'm trying it. So the guy's like, I've been doing it for, you know, 110 years, and my back's never been better.
I mean, if you If he lived 110 years old, it must be working, right?
It's true. So there's got to be something for it. So I'm trying it for like a month. We'll see what happens. If I come in like a body cast, then you know it didn't work out well.
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, we'll see.
All right.
Hey.
Last one. Let's Cheers. Do it. Cheers.
This is so full. All three of those in a row really hit me in a weird spot.
I can't remember if I ate today. That's not gonna be good.
Well, good thing we're not doing beer today.
Yeah, we got tea.
We're mixing it up. We're talking about pacifism, so we're drinking tea, and also Trey's the new uncle. So we're drinking tea.
Paul, explain your reasoning for wanting to do tea when I said, hey, I don't want to drink too much today. And you were like, tea is perfect.
Well, I was like, first off, I love tea.
Yeah.
And also, I'm like, oh, pacifism, peace, tea. I don't know why. Whenever I think of pacifism, I usually associate it with like that, yeah, man, you know, peace and love. I'm like, they probably drink
peace tea.
Yeah,
peace right. Peace tea, baby. No, well, you said tea, and I instantly went to the Boston Tea Party, and I was like, that's not pacifism. It actually, that's I think awesome. That falls under my category of pacifism, but
okay. We're gonna do it. So that's what I want to hear about that. But yeah, what kind of tea are you drinking?
I don't remember the brand, the flavor, or the mix. Mm-hmm. I don't know tea. It's called Vermont Maple Ginger, and it tastes like Christmas.
That's so fun.
Yeah, it smells so good. Really good.
So I've got one of my new favorites. And what's great is because I don't remember what the name of the company is. I know it's a company that mixes out in France. So this is an Earl Grey Lavender.
Ooh.
And it's nice. It hits good.
Mm.
It's one of my favorites. So there's that.
Yeah, good caffeine point too, I bet.
I hope so. But hey,
so
let's spill the tea.
This is gonna be fun.
I'm excited. This is one of those that I've been excited about for a while. So.
Well, I mean, I could go ahead and start talking, but also, like, I don't even know, like, what do you consider yourself?
I didn't actually, so I don't even know, like,
there's not a word for it.
There really isn't. It's like, you're normal or you're a pacifist.
whoa.
See, we don't feel the need to label everything. So.
I love my labels.
Is it a month expired? Who cares? There's no label. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what I'd call myself. So I'll get really biblical and Christianese on you. I would just call myself a peacemaker is the phrase that I would use.
Mm.
But I don't discount the use of violence in certain situations.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I consider myself a peacemaker too.
Or like a like a sissy one, right? No.
Yeah. I'm that's basically it. You know, like fighting scares me, so I stay out of it. I don't want to get hurt.
Yeah. Honestly, that's not a bad reason. I think that's what's funny about it, because I think some people think, because they watched a movie, they're like, oh yeah, if you're like really good, you won't get hurt and like people can't punch you. I'm like, you've obviously never been in a fight before. Like, you're gonna get hit. It doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't feel good.
I don't care for that. I don't care for that at all.
It doesn't feel good for anybody.
Well, my thing is being a pacifist has nothing to do with my own, you know, like my own protection. It, pacifism is more about the protection of others. So if I take a punch, I mean the cliche pacifist verse, right, is turn the other cheek. So right. Pacifists are, you're still going to get hit.
Yeah, just going to do it twice.
Yeah, you're just going to get hit twice instead of him hit you and then you hit him back, you know?
Well, so overall, like, how do you define pacifism? So the way I understand it is just like no reason for any kind of like physical force. There's no reason to use physical force, or like you avoid that at every possible cost.
So I mean, that's the more deontological definition of it. I mean, yeah. I think mine is more of a matter of virtue ethic, I guess is the right way to phrase it. So there is a hierarchy where there comes time where it's like, hey, we still have to get involved to protect the lives of others. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we don't, and I think this is where Dietrich Bonhoeffer comes in really well, because, you know, he's a notable pacifist who was in Germany during the time of World War II. And, you know, he had to deal with this issue of, hey, the whole world is at war. I'm in Germany. Hitler's like pretty close to me, and he's killing a whole lot of people. What do I do about the situation? And so, I mean, he became a spy and, you know, ultimately to take out Hitler.
Yeah, because their goal was like assassination attempts, wasn't it? He was kind of right, part of those. Yeah, that whole thing.
So Bonhoeffer came to the conclusion that Hitler had to be taken out for the good of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And so that does not fall under the deontological definition of pacifism.
So when I hear that, it's like, I wouldn't classify that as a form of pacifism. Mm-hmm. And it's just because in my brain, I stick to that idea of like, oh, like you don't use physical force. So would you say like there is moments when that is okay and you could still be a pacifist?
Honestly, I don't know if okay is even the right language to use.
Yeah, I'm kind of at a loss with fully understanding it.
this is where it gets really, really murky, because I don't think there's ever a justified time to kill another man.
Okay.
Right? There's never a justified time to kill another person. Like, I don't think Bonhoeffer had this. You're backing me into the corner already. But I don't think Bonhoeffer.
This was supposed to be the easy part so far.
I mean, we already went to Hitler, so like that's not good.
That one's on you, though.
Yeah, it is my fault. Huh? But Bonhoeffer is such a great example of what you brought up. So, but I still think like to have killed Hitler would have been a wrong. It would have been a wrong, but it would have been less wrong than allowing Hitler to do what he was doing, right?
Okay. So the lesser of two evils is how you'd classify that.
And I hate it. I hate it so much.
Well, because I think we're both ends don't justify the means. So,
exactly. Yeah.
You probably stick to that stronger than anyone I know. But
well, here's the thing, is people always give the all right, do they call it analogy? I don't know. I can't think of the term, but they're always like, okay, so you can time travel, you go back to when Hitler was a baby, you kill Hitler, right? It's like, no, that's not the answer. The answer is to parent him right in the truth of God to where he doesn't end up being this dictator who, you know, he wipes out so many, so many egregious
things.
He's
like, I need an enemy. How about the world? But no, I would agree with you on that as well. The lens I look through that in is a baby didn't commit those crimes. Like, he's not guilty of something he hasn't committed yet.
And so I guess that brings me to a good point where I think there are two motivations for anything. And those motivations are fear and love, right? And I think anytime we forego our nonviolent approach to influencing the rest of the world for the good, we allow part of the fear motivation to come in. So why kill Hitler? Because we're afraid of what he's doing. And we don't know how. Obviously, there was a way to stop Hitler without killing him. Like, he handled it himself. But that's not a good either, right? Because there's people hate talking about Hitler for this reason. People hate talking to me about Hitler for this reason.
I mean, let's be honest, he's not everyone's favorite topic. But like, no one, I don't think many people look forward to talking about him.
To kill Hitler would be to take away his path to redemption. And so I never think that is justified. And that's why I consider myself a pacifist. I don't think there's ever a time where we have the right to take another person's life.
Hmm.
Because to take another person's life is to condemn them and to judge them. Mm-hmm. That's a position that we do not hold.
So would you say like anybody, like nobody on earth has that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So our favorite. So what would you do with, let's talk biblically, with like Old Testament passages, mm-hmm. early Pentateuch, talking about like capital punishment, for example, mm-hmm. or saying like, hey, these people that God has put in charge, they have the right to judge people and condemn them for wrongs they have done to the society as a whole.
Yeah, well, I mean, you. If I answer this fully, we'll have to, you know, completely, you know.
And I know capital punishment is a completely different topic, but there is.
No. I think, I mean, I'm against capital punishment too, so it's not a problem to answer this.
Okay. And I figured you were based on your answer.
Let's not argue about what I'm about to say because it'll take the whole episode if we do.
Okay. Fair.
And it's not on topic, but you know, my approach to the Old Testament, like I've said before, is, you know, I don't believe the Old Testament or any scripture, you know, I believe it all to be inspired, but I don't believe any of it to be, you know, directly from the mouth of God. And I think there's a whole lot of, you know, psychologizing in the Old Testament, especially when it comes to the Pentateuch and especially when it comes to these developing these, you know, commandments and rules, which, you know, don't want to start an argument, but mm-hmm. contradict each other at times, right? And they seem to progress throughout the Old Testament themselves, right? Because you have the Pentateuch, where you have these rules, and then you have the prophets, and the prophets seem to say, hey, we are moving beyond this. And then, of course, Jesus comes in and says, hey, I'm fulfilling the law, right? And then Jesus gives a better image for what the Old Testament, you know, the Old Testament truths were really about. Right. The things that they were trying to get at, like the essence of the right way to live. Right. They were trying to pull out from what they saw around them and to create the rules that we find in the Pentateuch. And Jesus comes and makes the real rules more clear. And one of his rules is turn the other cheek.
Sure. And I know people love that one. I mean, in fair, it's not bad.
That's the pacifist motto, right?
Yeah.
And that's their main verse is, hey, if somebody wants to be violent against you, turn the other cheek.
Yeah. So it's interesting because then I hear on the opposite side, and this is kind of where I'm at with it. It's like, it's really hard to find someone who's honest about both sides of this. It's like I've struggled to find like a really nuanced approach to this concept, because it seems like you have two main camps. One of them saying like, yeah, no matter what happens, you just got to turn the other cheek. And then the other side that quotes like the sell your coat and buy a sword kind of thing in verses like that, because there's other verses talking about, hey, you should carry a sword or you should carry some way to protect yourself. And it's funny because I've heard pastors even on one side be like, this one says that you need to, I'll harp on this one because this is what the sermon was on. This guy talked for like 30 minutes on this one verse, which is just like, God, Jesus said, you know, sell your coat and buy a sword. Therefore, you need to own guns and you need to have this and blah, blah, blah. It's like, I see what you're saying, but it's like, you're being really dishonest. But then I hear like the, you need to turn the other cheek. You're just like, all right, I hear what you're saying, but you're being limited on like the context of, even if we just look at the New Testament, it's like, I feel like there's conflict with just that statement alone.
All right, where's the conflict?
So one of them being like, well, I guess the biggest one, the one I've been thinking about today mostly is just the idea of Jesus on the cross. It's like, okay, well, there's a form of capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And that was used as a good thing.
You can say that.
So, what? But I mean, there's other verses too that talk about, you know, carrying weapons, in ministry, being able to, I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, but it's like, basically the essence of that is like, you should be, you know, ready to defend yourself if needed. And I don't mean that. I'll define my stance a little bit here too, because I feel like I have to, from where I'm coming from. And it's the idea of, so I called myself a peacemaker, but I don't eliminate the use of force if necessary, but I do remove I don't condone necessarily the idea of offensive force, like you're initiating something. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a good approach. I think that is an unbiblical thing. I don't think Jesus or anyone in scripture condones the idea of someone says something bad about me, I should go just beat the crap out of them. I think that's a very unbiblical idea. But if someone is attacking your family, everyone loves jumping to that. But it's like, if there's other people that are innocently being attacked, I think, yeah, that's a place where we can use force to protect an innocent life.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at with it. I think, yeah, as much as possible, avoid the use of force, avoid a fight as much as you can. But sometimes it's unavoidable. Mm.
Yeah, and I prefer to stay in the abstract when it comes to to understanding it theologically, because when you get into like,
it's a lot less messy specific, to do that.
When you get into specific scenarios, it gets really messy.
Yeah,
because it's like you're gonna let them kill other people, and you're just gonna stand by and let it happen. And it's like, no, I'm gonna get involved. And it's like, we assume. Well, we don't assume, but it seems like the only thing we can do to stop, say, person one who is committing these, you know, hurts and killings and stuff, is killing other people. We automatically go to, well, we have to stop him by killing him. That's the best way to stop him, right? It's the quickest way, but it's not the only way. So that's the thing, is like, I don't think we know that's the surest way. It's like, so we want to take the surest path to stop the harm, but there also exists these whole other possibilities of outcomes where, you know, we could, I don't know, maybe he needs a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but we don't know that. If we gave him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, he would stop killing people. But how do you know that? You don't know that. So the only way we know that we know we can stop him. I know this is a crazy idea, but it's the first thing that came to my mind.
It's funny. Yeah.
All we know is that killing him will stop him from killing other people. So it's definitely the easiest way. So
in a way, it kind of brings us to the age old, idea or philosophical idea of, you got a train coming and there's one person on this track and five people on this track. Do you, you know, switch the gear to hit one person versus five, or do you just let it happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In a way, it's kind of the same concept that you're bringing up here.
It's such a sick concept, but.
Oh, it's terrible. Well, it's awful.
So, but that's a perfect example, right? Because we're only presented two options. Well, is there anything else that can stop a train?
No, that's it.
Sure, man. Another train. Yeah, kill the driver.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Like, that's how we see the train problem, right? Is there's mm-hmm. two options: either kill more or kill less. But there's other things that can stop a train.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like we don't have those things at hand. So the only decision we can make is let it happen or switch the track so it kills less people.
Sure.
And I know. So I mean, that's exactly what I'm kind of saying with this peanut butter and jelly sandwich thing here. You know.
Yeah. And I know it's like under perfect circumstances, that's great. And it also goes to, and people love this, where you have to bring it to like the fringe side of it. It's like, all right, this person, like, this train is like 10 feet away from these people, and you have just enough time to do one thing.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So it's like those situations too. That's kind of where I go. Cause if there's, and again, it's like, it depends on the situation. It's like in the vast majority of situations, I do believe, there's another option. You can avoid the harm that you have to cause on somebody. But then there are those times where it's like, there really is only like one or two options. I think those are very fringe, and those are not as common in everyone's day-to-day life. Thank God for that. But I think those are the ones that I guess for me, I'm hesitant. Maybe this goes back to the Bonhoeffer thing. So maybe you want to talk more about that.
Yeah.
Like, well, I think that's a perfect example of this kind of fringe case where it's like you are drawn to this level where it's like there really is only one option, it seems like.
Yeah. So, I mean, because Bonhoeffer was dedicated to his nonviolent pacifism, and then, you know, Hitler got his rise, and Bonhoeffer saw no other way forward other than, you know, becoming a spy and joining a collaboration to assassinate him.
Hmm.
So, I think from our side of things, we are so, you know, we don't have the hindsight to know what I think there's always a path forward, a path of complete love that prevents all violence from occurring. But we don't have the hindsight to know what that path is, which is why we choose the easier route of violence.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting even with that, too, because I wouldn't even say it's easier. I think it's like more sure sometimes. But I think that's something to recognize with that, too. It's like it's never, you know, causing harm to another person, whether that's, you know, breaking their arm or like killing them. I think it's like that's never an easy thing. And sometimes I think that can be more difficult.
Well, I'm not saying it's easy to kill somebody. I'm just saying that's.
I'm talking mentally, as far as like the toll it takes on you.
I know. It's not easy mentally. It's easy pragmatically, right?
Mm.
When there's no other, there seems to be no other option, that's the easiest one. Let's just kill him. Because we don't know how much he loves peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But
the dude just wanted to paint, right? He just wanted a nice oil paint set.
But the reason I'm dedicated to this form of pacifism, though, mm-hmm. is because I think we have to recognize, the people that aren't considering pacifism as a moral philosophy at all, right?
Hmm.
So think of your more further right conservative types who absolutely love the military and absolutely identify as Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things, their patriotism and their Christianity are completely intertwined together, right?
Yeah.
And so for at any cost, they will defend their country and God, right? It's God, country.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the saying is, that's completely anti-Christian because God, first of all, does not recognize America as this. We are not more God's people than the rest of the world is.
True.
Right. So to have that perspective is to think too highly of yourself that you think you can, that your life and Americans' lives are more important than anybody else's life in the rest of the world. But the rest of the world bears the image of God as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't replace America as God's holy promised land and at the risk of harming people of other countries. That's a strong motivation for my pacifism. Like, when I think pacifism, I think I am not pro American military using their power to harm individuals of other countries. Like, there's no American superiority in that, where America has this upper hand, where they have the freedom to go to war to protect America at the expense of other countries. Does that make sense?
I think so. I know the only thing that I would maybe change if I was to explain it would be the idea of just and unjust, where it's like, is what you're doing a just thing? So, like, we'll bring World War II back into it. That's an easy one to jump to. It's like, for me, I would say, that there was a sense of justice in what they were doing. There was a lot of innocent people being harmed. There was this very blatant attack on other people for the sake of it. It was, I think, what, you know, the Nazi Party was doing was like a very unjust thing to the rest of the world. And so the justice was to, okay, let's go and stop them. And that was at the cost of killing people as well. So in that sense, I would say it's like, there is like a just cause for that harm, even though it's at the stake of the Imago Dei.
Yeah, but see, you're not disagreeing with me on that point. The reason, the moral justification for America's involvement in World War II, which, of course, when I say moral justification, that's not me condoning war, but it's me saying it seems necessary that America got involved to prevent the harm of anybody, right? Any innocent person. So the path forward, of course, in World War II is kill the least amount of people possible to end the war. So it's the path of least harm. Although it seemed necessary that there was killings, right? Am I losing you?
No, I'm sorry, I'm listening. I guess for me, I'm trying to see like, okay, well, I'm trying to find, do we disagree on that? Because I think from what I just heard you say was you would, for lack of a better term, you put like a stamp of approval on that, even though it's a horrible thing to say.
I was trying not to.
Okay.
Yeah. Put a stamp of approval on what?
Oh, on the sense of like, okay, this is the right, I'll say right, or this is the right or best path to go down to in that example that we're using. You would say it's like, for America to be involved in that, that was the best and right thing to do because it caused the least harm to people.
Yeah. I mean, the distinction is it's not the least harm to America or the American people. It's the least harm to all people.
Yeah.
So there's no sense of American nationalism in that. It's not about protecting American people.
I don't mean that at all.
People at large.
Yeah. I don't mean that at all when I say that. I'm not making this political. I'm trying to separate that from the philosophy of it.
Yeah, of course.
Well, so it's interesting with that. So, because what I'm hearing is like, in a sense, you say, there is a place for where you would condone physical harm.
See, I
tried to make that as small as I could for you, as specific as I could.
That's the thing is, I want to say I never condone it.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's the whole thing I'm trying to present here is like from the abstract perspective, there's never a time where putting an end to another Imago Dei's life is ever justified because that eliminates their path to redemption. But, you know, with this World War II conversation, it seems like people are going to die. So take Hitler, for instance. He is killing millions of innocent people So the path of least murder is, it seems, not necessarily, but it seems like the path of least murder is to take him out. Take out the one instead of the millions.
Mm-hmm.
So in the abstract, there's got to be another way forward that doesn't involve taking out Hitler, but rather loving him, which that sounds so love, 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 sissy, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, that's your philosophy. That's not.
But that's what God does. God loves the evil out of you. So there's got to be a way forward where he receives the right amount of love that he stops being an idiot, right? And stops killing people. But we don't know what that is. So that's why I say that's the easy path forward, is just take him out and then we don't have to deal with it. We don't even have to consider what the path forward is. But the real answer would have been love. We just don't know the right way to love him. We don't know how he needs to receive that love in order to stop. All I'm saying is there's always another option available. We just don't know what that option is. And that's why I don't like getting into the physical side of it, because it's like, hey, time is of the essence. Like, that's what you made that distinction with the train analogy. And you were like, hey, well, the time, he only has 1 second to figure this out.
I threw another parameter on you for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But even then, I still feel like the other option is available. We just don't have the knowledge of it.
So let me pull it this way, because I think this might be a better way to articulate kind of my thoughts of what I'm hearing. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. So we'll look at like a child analogy in the sense of, okay, so you've got this, let's say we'll use the most stereotypical argument. So you've got a kid running out in the road. No, I don't like that one. Never mind. I'll use a different one. I didn't like where I was going with that. Let's just say you have a kid who's not going to eat his food. He's like, ah, I hate peas. I'm not going to eat them. And you're like, no, you have to eat these things. And he continues to be disobedient. It's like, I'm not going to forgive him every single time. There is a chance. There's going to be a moment where there are consequences for disobedience. Does that make sense? So I guess what I'm presenting here is the idea of consequences. And like, there is a time when the grace period runs out. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a judgment that needs to be made in order to love that person better.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. In order to love that person better, the consequences in their essence have to have essentially be restorative, right? There's no restoration in murder. And, you know, I tried to bring this up when we got in that fight about slavery, about the prison system, right? Mm-hmm. Like the prison system, the way it's designed, I'm not against people being given consequences for their wrong actions. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it should set them up for better, mm-hmm, rather than worse. But and what we see in the prison system is it doesn't restore people back to society. It actually puts them in a worse place than they were before.
Yeah, it's true.
So that's what I'm saying. We're not going to solve this problem. It's just
and I think that's
beyond our capacity.
That's right. I'm as much as I can. I know it's hard sometimes. I'm trying to like remove it from all these other like very charged conversations and try to keep it to like the philosophy of like, is there, I guess for me, it's like, I guess I always argue like there is a time when it sounds terrible saying, but it's like, there is a moment when ending someone's life is a justifiable thing, even though it's not easy and it's not preferred. I'd never prefer that, but there is a moment when like, that is the justifiable thing to do. When it's at the cost of someone else's innocent life.
But the problem with that is it's not the only option. There's always an option. I know I keep harping on this, but there's always an option that keeps that person alive. Hmm. Take capital punishment, for instance. We can protect the innocent people that a murderer has murdered, a murderer might potentially murder by imprisoning him, right? Mm-hmm. And then he's going to go on trial and he might get he might get the verdict of capital punishment.
Yeah.
We don't have to do that. In fact, it costs the government money to do that, to not do that, which is another justification for why I'm against it.
is it costs the government more money. So why don't we just keep them alive?
I love spending money, though.
But while the murderer is imprisoned, he cannot harm anybody else. So problem solved, and we haven't killed anybody. So when is there actually an instance where murder is absolutely necessary? I would say, I'd say a soft necessary. Like, I think the case of Hitler, that's a soft necessary, but it's not an absolute necessary. So I feel like I keep, you know, repeating myself over and over again, but I'm just trying to clarify what I'm trying to say. It's like, what I'm really saying is violence is never absolutely necessary, although it can be pragmatic and it can be the more secure way and the more obvious way to ending more violence. And so I'm just taking a hard stance of it's never absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting with that, because I guess what I'm hearing is like what I'm trying to hear. It's like the kind of the undertones of that too. Cause we, I think both of us have been kind of just repeating our stances a few times.
We're trying to understand each other. It's fine.
Yeah, it's true. So I guess I'm trying to understand, cause I think there's, and I have other friends that share that belief with you as well. And I think I'm trying to look at like, okay, what's the undertone of that? And it sounds like one of them is the idea of, I'm trying to think of how to say it really well without making things more confusing. But you've used this word before too, the idea of restoration. And so it sounds like you're in the place of like, oh, someone can always be restored. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say? Okay. And I think for me, I'm of a different mindset when it's like, yes, there is a time for restoration, but there's a time when like they've outgrown that grace period. And it's like the time for restoration is over. I think that's what I was trying to say with the child example, was like, okay, yes, there's a time where I'm going to give you grace and forgiveness during this, but there's a time when it's done. And I think that's the fundamental difference that we have in our approach to this. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, you believe the path you believe. I'm on this opposite end, is because, yeah, I guess I put a line at some point. It's like, okay, there's a point where you've passed the point of restoration, which it sounds horrible to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that gives me the easy shortcut of, well, that's not how God treats us. And that limits the goodness and love of God, because God never stops extending love and grace toward us. And so for us to take a violent route of ending somebody's life, no matter what they did, no matter what heinous crimes they've committed, that is for us to put ourselves in the position of God and say, hey, God's goodness has run out for you. Your time is up. No more grace for you. Donezo. But God never does that for us. So where do we get the authority to do that to other people?
So I think that's where, and maybe this is teasing another episode too, because okay. I know we're getting short on time, unfortunately, which is just the idea of hell. To say it very bluntly, very basically.
Of course.
And I think we might find our ideas of those are probably different. Where for me, I would say, well, yeah, when you die, that's your end of grace. It's like, if you haven't come to put it super simply, if you haven't come to believe in Christ, then it's like your grace period's over. He's allowed you to live this long, but you haven't, you know, submitted yourself to him. You haven't believed in Christ. And that's where I'd say, well, your grace time's over. Now it's time for your judgment, and it's not going to look good. And I think you'd probably argue something different, is what it sounds like.
In order to not get into the hell conversation, I'm just going to quote C.S. Lewis. I'm just going
to quote C.S. Lewis. It'd be so easy to jump into right now.
Because I think this gets to the root of what we're talking about here. Is C.S. Lewis said, hell is well, this is just going to be a paraphrase because I can't remember word for word.
Atreia phrase.
Hell is being locked in a room and the lock is on your side.
Okay.
You've locked yourself in hell. God doesn't lock you in. Right. And don't, I mean, that's kind of what I believe about hell in general.
I won't jump into it.
But when it comes to this restoration thing, that's more of what, take that symbolically for like living a psychological hell on earth. The kind of hell that you have to live in to commit mass genocide, right? Because there's no way hell was in a heaven mindset. That man, there's no way, right? So he lived in a hell of his own devices.
Yeah, it's unfortunately I haven't actually read the book, but it is like it's a weird idea, and I think that's that harsh reality of the this state that we're living in. the idea of like how could, so the book I'm referring to that I've never read but I've heard a lot about is what is it even called?
Who's the author?
Is it Some Good Men?
Who's the author?
I don't remember. I think it's like Some Good Men or something like that. But so the idea of the book, this might help some people. And I actually do need to read it. I have it saved in my queue somewhere. Okay. I think I have an audiobook version of it. But it's the idea of, okay, it looks at the philosophy of how did, it looks at Nazi Germany. How did these people, it's called Ordinary Men. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. Yep. How do these ordinary people go from living, ordinary lives? They go to work, they buy the groceries, they make dinner, they play with their kids, whatever. How do they go from that to just the atrocities that they committed?
Yeah.
What leads a person to getting to that place?
Yeah.
And it's a really thick, philosophy theology behind that, which is a huge conversation. But I would agree. That's not a heaven mindset.
Yeah.
That's someone who has allowed themselves to be wrapped up in their own depravity.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is ordinary. I know about ordinary men.
Oh, cool.
It's and I kind of want to, I haven't read it, but I want to kind of summarize what
we're in the same
I
boat then.
It sounds depressing. Why would I want to read that?
I know, it really does.
No, but it's, what causes a person to become a Nazi is one little lie at a time. That's kind of what Solzhenitsyn was talking about how he ended up in a Russian gulag, right? He blamed himself for being imprisoned in a gulag in Russia. What?
Yeah.
Why is that his fault? Well, he said because he, one lie at a time, his character wasn't right. Right. And that's what got him and everybody else in this situation. And that's what happens with us is one lie at a time. And why do we lie? Mm-hmm. Because we're afraid. But fear motivates lies. And the it builds up resentment as well. So fear motivates lies and fear motivates resentment. And as that builds up, it seems like I think a good analogy to use would be every lie is a layer of ice. It's a layer of ice. It's a layer of ice until somebody comes along and they've got an ice pick, but it's not strong enough to get to the core. Right. And so that's what happened with Hitler, right? There doesn't seem to be, the ice pick represents love, right? There didn't seem to be an ice pick strong enough to bust through that barrier of ice. And so I don't know what the analogy for killing him would be, but anyways,
blowtorch. I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just coming up with analogies on the spot today. I don't know what's getting into me.
This tea is messing with us now.
Some funky tea, but
yeah, it's, there's a lot of subtext to kind of what we're saying too. Yeah. And I'm sure we've made people angry on, cause we, this conversation, what we've touched on dives into the stuff that we said we weren't really that interested in talking about, which is the free will Calvinism thing. And we'd probably make people on both sides angry.
Probably, yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, there's a lot there.
Well, I don't want to go without quoting some Martin Luther King Jr. because he's my pacifist role model. So he's got this one short quote about pacifism that I think really summarizes it. The thing with, you brought up a story earlier in the conversation that I wanted to push back on, because you kind of made it sound like pacifists are passive, right? They just don't want to get involved. And that's why they're not, that's why you're a peacemaker, whereas pacifists are just passive, right?
Yeah.
And I'm putting words in your mouth and I'm making you sound worse. No, it didn't sound that bad when you said it.
As a blanket statement, I'm painting a very broad brush.
Yeah.
Hearing kind of more the nuance to what you're saying too, it does change that for you particularly. But when I think of pacifism as a whole, I think of peacekeeper versus peacemaker.
Mm-hmm. No, I think pacifists are very much involved in the peacemaking process. And I think that's what we saw. That's what Dr. King did, right? Not in any means just a peacekeeper. He was, I mean, he disrupted a lot of peace and order. Ooh, we should have got into how Jesus did that. Because, I mean, at one point, Jesus says, right? Jesus says, hey, I came to make peace. And then another time, he says, no, I didn't. I came to cause division. So, how are those two things not contradicting? They're not contradicting because it takes disrupting this facade of peace, right? This fake peace that we think we're living in. We have to disrupt that in order to make real, true peace. Mm-hmm. And Jesus did that, and he did it in a nonviolent way.
I would disagree with the violent way. I don't think he necessarily caused violence. Unless we want to talk about flipping tables over.
That's not violence.
But that's another thing. But I think that when we look at that, it's like it's a construction zone. You know, it's like if we want to build a new house, we got to destroy a whole lot of crap to make something look pretty.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, if we want to look at a whole, this is, I think, where we would agree. That's what Jesus did. He came in with a bulldozer and then started trying to build it up again.
Yeah. But he did so in a way that didn't cause anybody else harm. I don't know what to think about.
Yeah.
My computer's acting funny, so.
Yeah. And he's telling us to wrap it up, dang it.
All right, so I'll just...
That's a fun conversation right there alone.
Yeah, I should have brought Jesus into it from the beginning, you know? Might have made... But here's like a definition from a Dr. King quote, and then I'll read one of his other more famous quotes. So he says, "Nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation." So, I mean, to dedicate yourself to a pacifist life will cause social transformation. Not because it doesn't take force and swords and guns to convince people to change toward the good. Right. And that's part of my strong conviction of pacifism is I think when we use force to manipulate people toward the good, then we failed in our influence. We haven't actually influenced. We've co-opted. We've coerced. That's not true moral change.
Yeah. So I guess, and I want you to end with the quote too.
Yeah.
But I'll say just for myself. There's a level, there's a huge level that I agree with, but then there's also a point where I disagree with. And so I agree. It's like, yeah, there is, I would agree with the idea that there's 99% of the time there is an approach that doesn't end in physical harm on another person. But I guess what I disagree with is just the idea of, you know, with the reality that I've lived up to this point, that there are times when sometimes it does come to that. Sometimes the best way for change to happen is for the sake of innocent people, for the sake of and I hate saying it that way because it it can be you know, inflammatory sometimes, I think.
No, I don't think so.
But the idea is like, yeah, at the cost of an innocent life, sometimes you do need to cause physical harm to another. And I think there are times when that is a just thing. I don't think it's always the case. I don't think it's something that we need to be, and this is where I think that when I pulling from scripture, this is where I come out of it with, is that, yeah, we are not called to be offensively violent to other people. We're not called to, if someone says, calls us a name, we're not called to just, you know, punch them and beat them down to the ground. That is not what we're called to do. But there are times when to protect another person, to protect another life, sometimes to protect our own, we are called to enact physical harm on another. So I think that's where I would end with mine. And again, that dips into, you know, that whole subplot that we need to talk about at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll clarify my position one last time before I read this quote and kind of like interrelate it to what you're saying. I mean, you use the language of it, sometimes it seems necessary that the best way forward is this violent approach. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that completely, because it seems, and that's where it's, we have to do the apparent good. The violence seems like it appears to be the best way forward. And all I want to argue is, even though it appears to be necessary and it appears to be the best way forward,
yes,
it just never is.
Yeah.
Even though it appears to be that way. So
just to say that one last point, I'm going to end with this, because we could talk more about this, is I think the only difference then is I would say in my definition that, not that it seems, but it is. I think that's where put that assurance on that. But yeah, continue.
I also don't like the language of being called to do that, but that's fine. I'll let that be. I don't think, my personal belief is that God never calls us to commit violence. But anyways, here's you might recognize this one. This is another Dr. King quote.
Dr. King.
Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness in the descending spiral of destruction. The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken or shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation.
Good stuff. I'm laughing because, I'm sorry, Andy. we're gonna end with this. I'm laughing because it's funny because we can both listen to it like that's really good, but for two completely different reasons.
Yeah.
We agree with the same thing, but for different conclusions.
Yeah, I hear that quote and I'm like, that is exactly what I'm saying. And you hear it and you're like,
exactly. Preach it, man.
Hey, man, I'll leave it up to your conscience to decide. But
yeah,
I think this conversation was helpful because I've never really had an intense conversation about pacifism. So this really helped me clarify, you know, the things I believe. So thanks for that.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for being open and willing to talk about that. It's funny because it's like, I think you have a different approach to it than I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate you being open and willing to discuss that, just like everything we talk about.
Yeah, of course. That's the nature of the podcast, right?
It's true. That's what we're here for.
Conversations that are not easy to answer.
But yeah, you know, for you guys watching, you guys listening, let us know what you think. We've got an Instagram that we're pumping out.
Yeah, that's right.
That's tipsy_theology. Look us up on the IG. Is that the slang now? I guess
that's the slang. Sure, yeah,
that's the slang, boy. All right. Check us out, give us a follow, send us a like, DM us, let us know what your thoughts are. Do you consider yourself a pacifist? What does that mean? So I there's the broad brush stroke, there's the nuanced approach, and then there's whatever approach I have. But yeah, thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and thank you so much to Maximize Digital Media and Annie Yuli for telling us to wrap it up and producing this episode.
That's right, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Yeah, we will.